Wanted to talk about a topic that is very relevant to Hanukkah, but also relevant throughout the course of the year. And I think it would be very bold of a statement to say that this is perhaps, potentially, the most difficult mitzvah in Kol HaTorah Kula. Now, how can you say that? There are some of us who struggle with certain areas of life and certain mitzvahs. There are others who struggle with others. How can someone boldly declare that one mitzvah is going to be more difficult than any other? So let me read you from the words of the Chasam Sofer. Chasam Sofer was one of the great Gedolim in the 1800s, where he says, Kol yamai hayisi mitzdar al mikra hazeh. My entire life I agonized, I was troubled and concerned about this particular mitzvah. And what is this mitzvah? The Torah says, V'hi yisem nikiyim mehashem umei Yisrael. V'yisem nikiyim means I should be virtuous in the eyes of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, in God's eyes, and in the eyes of the Jewish people. So what does that mean? It means being clean, being virtuous in the eyes of God means you do the right thing. What does it mean to be clean in the eyes of other people? Says the Chasam Sofer, that is an impossible ask of a person. How can you tell me that I should uphold a standard where nobody is ever going to think that I may be doing something wrong? I can't control other people's emotions, other people's thoughts. So people can have the wildest imagination about me, even though it's very far from the reality of what is really happening, and yet I'm in violation of something that the Torah mandates me of. Says the Chasam Sofer, this to me is the most impossible mitzvah in the world. If God tells me, do this or don't do that, I can protect myself to make sure that I do this properly or I don't do that. But how can HaKadosh Baruch Hu expect of me that I'm going to live my life in a way where nobody on the periphery of my life is ever going to think negatively about what it is that I'm doing? How can I control what they think? So says the Chasam Sofer, Beis Chovos Elu, these two expectations, these two obligations of number one, V'yisem Nikiyim Me Hashem, and number two, Me Yisrael, and these are Shnei Rochvim Tzmadim Al Gabenu, these are two weighty burdens that are on our shoulders all the time. Number one, we're always concerned about what HaKadosh Baruch Hu thinks of us, and how he feels about our behavior. And number two, we're worried about how other people interpret what it is that we do as well. The Yoser of Shari, he says, it is sometimes in some way it is easier. Lotzeis yidei achov harishon. It is easier in some way to make God happy. Mi lotzeis yidei abrios. Ki heim choshvim achshav azoros. Because people have wild imaginations. People fantasize. People make assumptions. People make projections. V'nosnim v'nosnim Moses b'levana. And there's all kinds of gossipers out there in the world. And therefore he says, it's very, very difficult to make sure that I live life trying to uphold a standard where everyone I interact with will believe and understand that I'm living life the way I'm supposed to. That is a very, very difficult task. And he says that he wonders. You know, the Pasuk says, Adam ein tzadik ba'aretz asher yasa tova lo yechta. Pasuk says, there is no one in the world, Shlomo HaMelech says, no one in the world who has lived all of life perfectly without ever doing anything wrong. And says the Chasam Sofer, perhaps that is a reference to this particular mitzvah. There is nobody in the world. You can be as careful and as scrupulous and as meticulous as possible in all of your observance of mitzvos and keeping away from averus, but yet he says, there's no one in the world who ever did something that nobody else ever thought negatively about. It's just impossible. We live in a society, we interact with people, and this is just the nature of people. They think whatever they think. And says the Chasam Sofer, maybe this is what it means when Shlomo HaMelech says, Adam ein tzadik ba'aretz asher yasa tov v'lo yechta. Okay. So let us try to delve into this important topic. It's relevant, as we mentioned, not only to Hanukkah, but also is germane to many different situations throughout the course of the year as well. Now, whenever we discuss any topic in Halacha, the first question that we need to ask ourselves is this something that is a din d'oraisa or only a din d'rabbanan? Is this something that is biblical or is it something that is only rabbinic? What is the difference? Either way, we have to make sure that we observe it, whether it's something that the Torah expects us to observe or it's something that only the rabbis, the chachamim, expect us to observe. The answer is, the difference will be when you have a suffix, when you have a case of doubt. So we have a general principle, which is suffix d'oraisa l'chumra. Whenever you have a doubt when it comes to a mitzvah mid'oraisa, you have to be machmer, you have to be stringent to make sure you don't make a mistake. However, suffix d'rabbanan, when you're dealing with something which is only rabbinic in nature, so then we say l'kula. You have a right to be more lenient, and you don't have to be as concerned as you would be if we were dealing with a din d'oraisa. So that is the first question we need to ask. So we turn to a Mishnah in Meseches Shkalim. Let's see in the first on the source sheet, The Mishnah Masechah Shkalim is a very interesting Mishnah. So why is it in Masechah Shkalim? What does this have to do with Masechah Shkalim? The din of Marasa Ayin and Chashad. Marasa Ayin means if people are going to mistakenly think, actually there's two different terms. There's Chashad, means someone is going to see what I'm doing, and Bichoshed, which means they're going to suspect that I'm doing something wrong. There's Maris Ayin, which means some people may see what I'm doing and then learn for themselves, come away with the wrong takeaway message, and do something wrong as a result of what I'm doing. Okay, so those are two variations of the same theme. Why does this find itself in the Mishnah and Masechah Shkalim? Masechah Shkalim is all about, we know that in the Beis HaMikdash, they used to offer karbanos every day. Karbanos were not offered on behalf of private people. The collective karbanos were offered on behalf of the Jewish people. Now, how can the Jewish people, in the collective sense, offer a karban every day? Who's paying for it? So every year, they used to make what they refer to as a Machzis HaShekel collection. So we know that Erev Purim, we have a pan and shul that says Machzis HaShekel on it, but this really comes from the days of the Beis HaMikdash, where everyone used to give a Machzis HaShekel, and they used to contribute to the public cause of funding their karbanos. This way, every day when they offer a karban, they would be able to take from that fund. My father often says that it's a little bit of a misnomer. People think that they give a Machzis HaShekel every year. It's not so true. What happened was, they used to make a calculation of how much money they projected it was going to cost for the year to offer karbanos every day. Not always going to be the same. The market changes. Animal prices go up and down, fluctuate. Things change. Economy changes. So they made a projection of what they thought they were going to need. They made a projection of how many Jews usually contribute. They didn't have a census. They didn't know exactly how many Jews there were, but they knew on a normal year how many people actually contribute to the cause, and they split it up accordingly. So some years it was a Machzis HaShekel that's all they needed, and other years it was going to be $25 a person in order to be able to fund it for the year. Whatever it may have been, that was the story of the Machzis HaShekel collection, and that is what the entire Masechah Shkalim discusses. All the details of who's obligated to give, who's part of the count, who is included in the karbanos, and how do we collect it, and when do we collect it, which time of the year. So here the Mishnah says as follows. After we made the communal collection, and everyone gives their money in, where do they put it? They don't have a bank account, so where do they put it? So you have all this money, and you have a treasurer of the Beis HaMikdash, and I would venture to say they probably chose some very upstanding Kohen who was going to be in charge of the treasury of the Beis HaMikdash, and they have this person go in to then count to see how much they ended up with, how much they still need, what's short, do they have extra, do they have too little? And this is the discussion that the Mishnah has here. So we're told, the treasurer of the Beis HaMikdash, this Kohen who's been appointed for the job, goes in to this room, and this is where they kept all of these coins, all the money, and he walks in. So the Mishnah tells us, what is he allowed to wear when he goes into the room? Says the Mishnah as follows. Hanichnas litrom es halishka. If you have the treasurer who's going in to count up all the money that came in. Says the Mishnah, eno nichnas lo b'minal, he's not allowed to wear shoes. V'lo b'sandal, he's not allowed to wear sandals. V'lo b'tfilin, he's not even allowed to wear his tfilin. Why? What's the concern? Shema, says the Mishnah, maybe, yichashdu bo sheganav mimo es halishka. Maybe people are going to suspect that he stole money, that he diverted money from the treasury, and he hid it in his sandals or in his shoes, and now he walked out, and later on in the year, all of a sudden, he buys a new car or a new house, and people are going to say, oh, we know why he was able to afford a new house or a new car, because he was the treasurer in the Beis HaMikdash, and he stuffed a couple of coins into his shoes, and that's why he made so much money this year, and that's how he was able to afford his big fancy vacations, and the cruises he went on, and everything he did, was all because of that money that he stole from the Machzis HaShekel. Okay, that's what the Mishnah says. Now, the Mishnah then says, you have to be careful that whenever you're involved in something where people can suspect you, Shenemar, the Torah says, V'yisem nikiyem me'ashem me'yisrael. If you would just take this Mishnah at face value, you would say, the Mishnah says, Shenemar, it says, this is stated in a pasuk, so from there it would seem to be that this is a din deoraisa. We have another example of this. The Mishnah says in Maseches Peah. What's the halacha in Peah? Peah is when you have a farmer who's working the field. So we're told that he has to leave over a corner of his field in order that it should be able to be used for the aniyim, for the people in need, should be able to come and collect from the corner of the field. Now, the Mishnah says that when he leaves over, Amro Torah lahaniach Peah b'sof sadeh. there are many corners of a field. It depends how you look at it, right? If you're looking from where I stand or from where you stand, different places. So the Mishnah says no. You have to leave over a corner of the field at the edge of the field. Why? Why do you have to do that? Says the Mishnah, Mipnei ma, careful, listen carefully to the words. Mipnei ma amra Torah. Why does the Torah mandate that you have to leave over the peah not just anywhere in the field, but at the corner of the field where everyone can see it? Because people are going to be choshed, people are going to suspect that maybe you didn't do the mitzvah peah. And if they don't see it somewhere in a visible area where there's a sign up, they're going to assume that you didn't do the mitzvah. So because of that, the Torah says you have to leave over peah not just anywhere in the field, it has to be in a very obvious, visible place in the structure of your land that everyone should be able to see it. That is what the Gemara says. And this also would seem to be an indication that this is a din d'oraisa. After all, the Gemara introduces this by saying, Mipnei ma amra Torah. However, it is clear if you look in the Rishonim, and this is the consensus of most of the Acharonim as well, that this is only a din d'rabban. This is something that is only rabbinic in nature, this whole idea of maras ha'ayim. Now, it's very interesting if you think back to the original case that we spoke about, when you have somebody who's going in to be Torah Mesalishka. Isn't it strange, and we're going to get back to this later on in the shir, isn't it strange? Do you think somebody's going to hide money in his tefillin? He's going to open up his tefillin, take out the parashios, and stuff some money in there? I mean, and who are we talking about? We're talking about a Kohen, not just a Kohen, obviously somebody who the whole enterprise of the Beis HaMikdash trusted, otherwise they would fire him from being the treasurer. He wouldn't have the job. So you're dealing with a trustworthy person who's been put into this position because he is trusted by others, and yet we're concerned not only that he's going to stick some money into his shoes or his sandals, but we're concerned that maybe he's going to open up his tefillin and he's going to hide some stuff in there. I always thought this is a very strange consideration that we have to worry about, until somebody told me a number of years ago that in Ben Gurion Airport they found someone who was going through with his tefillin, and inside of the parshios of the tefillin he took it out. Inside of the tefillin he stuffed drugs. He was trying to smuggle drugs in, and he tried to get into Israel and they caught him. So I guess it's not so outlandish. It's not so unheard of. But again, it's just an interesting point, and we'll have to come back to it a little bit later. So this is definitely something that would seem, according to the Rishonim, is only a din derabbanan, and that is why we find many different experiences where we would say you have a right to be makel, you have a right to be lenient, because after all, we're only dealing with a din derabbanan. So we have this concept of maras ha'ayin. What is an example? Say, for example, one of the aseres hadibros is lo sasa lecha pesel v'chol tumuna. You're not allowed to make an idol. You're not allowed to make an idol. Okay. Now, the Gemara Maseches Avodah Zarah says, if I have a ring, and the ring has some kind of insignia on it, so I didn't make it, says lo sasa lecha, you're not allowed to make it, but I didn't make it. Someone gave it to me as a gift. Am I allowed to wear it on my finger? It's a beautiful ring. Am I allowed to wear it? Says the Gemara Maseches Avodah Zarah, no. Why? Shalo yomru, people who see me wearing this ring are going to think, lahu ovi, people are going to think, oh, the reason why they have that ring is not because it's so beautiful and the art is so special and specific and unique and something that you want to wear, but rather you're wearing it because you bow down to this ring, because you believe that whatever image is on there is an Avodah Zarah. Now, this is not relevant to us today because nobody in our community has an Avodah Zarah that's in the shape of a ring. We don't have such things. So if you have a ring and it has some kind of design on it, don't be concerned. But the Gemara is talking about a time when people actually did have such a thing. And therefore, even if the Jew is wearing it not because they have any service to Avodah Zarah, but because they just think it's pretty, they wouldn't be allowed to because of Maaras Ha'ayin. People who see you are going to think you're violating the Isser De'oraisa, so the biblical prohibition of Lo Sasa Lecha Pesel. Similarly, the Gemara says in Maseches Avodah Zarah Daf Yibeis, let's say I have a Mayan HaMoshech Lefnei Avodas Kochavit. Let's say I have a stream of water that is right in front of an idol. So I want to just go down to get a drink. The problem is that when I bend down to get a drink, they designed it specifically in this way that every person who bends down to get a drink is automatically bowing down to the Avodah Zarah. And there's no other way to get the water. So would I be allowed to take water? Because the only reason why I'm here is because I want the water. It so happens that by bending down to get it, I'm going to now have to bow down to the idol. Is this something I have to be concerned about or not? Says the Gemara, you're not allowed to drink from that fountain. Why? Because it's nirek mishtachav el Avodah Zarah. Even though all your Jewish friends know that, of course, you're not an idol worshiper. Everybody knows that you're not bending down because you want to bow down to the Avodah Zarah, but rather because you want a drink of water. Still, we have to be concerned of chashad, of maris ha'ayin. Okay. So those are two very simple examples that the Gemara gives, among many. Those are just two very simple examples of where somebody who will see you doing this, they will mistakenly get the impression that you are violating an Isser D'oraisa, that you're doing something wrong on a biblical level. Do I even need to be concerned when the person who's watching what I'm doing will at worst think that I'm only violating an Isser D'Rabbanan? Is that question clear? Do I need to be concerned that if somebody sees what I'm doing, at worst case scenario, even if what I'm doing in their mind is correct, is what they think I'm doing, which is not, but even if they think what I'm doing is wrong, at worst, what they're going to think is that I'm violating an Isser D'Rabbanan. Do I still need to be concerned about that? That is a very interesting discussion that finds itself in the Shulchan Aruch Yeredeya Simen Pei Alf. So here's the following case. Shulchan Aruch says, it just doesn't sit right with me, but the Shulchan Aruch says that for all intents and purposes, mutter lishtos chalav isha behusha pirish. We would be allowed to drink human milk. It's kosher. Behusha pirish. It wouldn't be appropriate to take a drink directly from a woman. However, if you have bottled milk that was expressed and is now in the refrigerator, I would be allowed to drink that. It's considered kosher milk. There's nothing wrong with it. Now, parenthetically, the Rishonim ask, why is that kosher milk? We have a halacha Masechas Bechoros. The Gemara says in Bechoros Daf Zayin that not only are non-kosher, don't mistake me for saying the wrong thing here. It's the Gemara's discussion. The Gemara says when you have a non-kosher animal, so the non-kosher animal is not kosher, correct? Anything that is an extract of the non-kosher animal is kosher or not? Non-kosher. So for example, I have an animal that produces milk. So not only is the animal itself prohibited from being eaten, but the milk that is an extract from that animal is also not allowed to be eaten. So is human flesh something that is permissible to eat? I know it's a horrible question to ask, but no, why not? Why is it not kosher? We don't have split hooves. We're not animals, so we're not bound. We're not bound. So this is a good question, right? Who said that Basar Adam is not permissible? The Ramban actually says, cannibalism is not allowed only because we're not allowed to kill people, right? So you're not just allowed to destroy people's lives. But who said theoretically, who said that Basar Adam is not kosher? The Ramban comes to the conclusion, Basar Adam, human flesh, must be kosher, because otherwise, how can we have a halacha? The Gemara says in Ksubas that human milk is kosher. So how could it be? If the human body is not kosher, then how can an extract of the human body be kosher? Good question? It's a good question. So this is just something to think about. Maybe it's not relevant to you so much, so you don't think about it, but it's something that the Rishonim actually discussed. Would we say that there's a prohibition of Eiver Menachai? Would you say that human flesh is not permissible? I'm sorry, I'm grossing you out. But would you say there's a problem of human flesh because that's Eiver Menachai? And if that's the case, then you have to explain why is it that an extract of something that is not permissible is allowed to be eaten? Be it as it may, again, a discussion for another time, the Shulchan Aruch clearly comes to the conclusion that one would be allowed to drink milk that was expressed from a human, and there's no halachic problem with that at all. Question now becomes, is that milchix or flacius?
Parv.
Parv. Okay. So it's milchix, flacius, or parv. All those who say parv, raise your hands. Okay, you're right.
Parv, mom's eye, you can't.
It's advanced. All right, take it easy. One question at a time, right? So it's parv. It's parv. So what does that mean now? So it's parv would mean that I should probably be allowed to cook fleishigs with it, because it's parv. Now, again, to me, it's gross. I would never do such a thing. But I guess people have all kinds of recipes. I don't know. So this is the question. Would there be any prohibition to use that milk to cook meat with? Or would you say, no, that is a prohibition of basar b'chalav? You'll see in a minute why this is a very important discussion. So the Rajba, one of the Gedolei HaRishonim in the 1200s, in Barcelona, in Spain, Rabbi Shlomo ben Aderes, the Rajba writes as follows. Let's see what he says in number base. Od sha'alta, basar b'chalav isha mahu. Would I be allowed to cook my meat together with this human milk or not? Kivan she'chalav isha achar shapirish mutter. After all, the Shulchan Aruch says that once you have the milk is expressed, a person would be allowed to eat it. Im kein ein bazei iser klal. Therefore, I should say, what's the problem? It's pariv, nothing wrong. So go use it for your recipe. Or aser mishen ma'aras ayin. Maybe we should say that this is a problem because everybody who walks by and sees you pouring a white substance into your meat dish doesn't really know how to differentiate or distinguish between this milk and that milk. All they see is something white in a bottle. They assume that that is regular milk. Why would they assume otherwise? Especially that nobody ever cooks with that milk, right? So why should they assume it's anything other than regular milk from an animal? And therefore he says, we have to be concerned that maybe there's an issue of maris ayin. Somebody who sees you doing this is going to assume that they're allowed to eat basar b'chalav. They're allowed to cook basar b'chalav, or that you are eating or cooking basar b'chalav. That is the question that was posed to the Rashba. The answer he writes is tshuva. The answer that he suggests is mistaver. It seems she'aser levashlo. You are not allowed to cook with it. V'kol shekein la'achlo. You're certainly not allowed to eat it, because that would be a problem of maris ha'ayin. Okay. Can we think about a little bit more of a relevant example than this? What would that be? Yeah? Right, a dairy creamer, something like a non-dairy creamer. Right, if you have something that's a milk substitute or almond milk, would that be something that is permissible or perhaps not? So again, I only gave the extreme example because that's where the discussion stems from in the Gemara, but then it gets to much more practical terms when we talk about our recipes today. And many of our recipes call for a milk substitute in different variations. Of course, it's non-dairy, but the question is that problematic to use or not? So let's see. The Rama writes in Simen Pei Zayin. The Rama says as follows: Nagu lasos chalav mishkedim. We have the practice that we have almond milk, which was considered a big breakthrough. They have almond milk. Umanichem ba b'sar of, and we cook with this almond milk. B'sar of means chicken. Now, why does he say chicken? Hoil ve'eno rak min derabanan, says the Rama. Since that is only a rabbinic prohibition. What does that mean? What does that mean? So if you look in the Pasuk in Chumash, it says, which means, you're not allowed to cook meat with milk. That's the original prohibition on a biblical level, meat and milk together. Go down a notch. What if I have something that is not meat, and I cook that with milk? What would that be? So again, the two top levels would be meat and milk together. Keep the milk at the top level, and add in, instead of meat, have chicken. So that would only be rabbinic. Rabbinically prohibited, because chicken is not the same as meat. Midrabanan, they said, rabbinically they said, you have to be careful about chicken as well, because chicken and meat are interchangeable. People eat them all the time together, and therefore if you're going to have chicken with milk, people are going to mistakenly have meat with milk as well. So rabbinically they said you're not allowed to have chicken with milk the same way you're not allowed to have meat with milk. Okay, what if I bump it down two notches? Not only I have a substitute for the meat, but now I have a substitute for the milk also. So I have chicken and fake milk. I have chicken and almond milk. So what would that be? That's what the Rama is discussing. So he says, worst case scenario, you're only going to be in violation of an Issur d'Rabbanan, because we're only dealing with chicken. So if it was chicken and real milk, I would only violate an Issur d'Rabbanan. So now, what are people going to think? Worst case scenario, says the Rama, all they're going to think is that I'm violating a rabbinic prohibition. Correct? Does that make sense? Therefore, the Rama says, you don't have to be concerned, and you're allowed to use the almond milk when cooking a dish with chicken. However, he says, aval b'sar behema, but if you have real meat, not chicken, but you have real meat, then if you want to use the chalav shkedim, if you want to use this almond milk, you would have to put the nuts from the almond right next to the recipe, that everyone who sees will be able to clearly identify, oh, there are almonds right here, it must be that you cracked the almond, took out the milk, and that's the ingredient that you're using. So that's what the Rama says. And the Shach there says, I don't understand why it would matter. If the whole nature of the prohibition of Maris Ayin is, someone is going to see what I'm doing and assume that I'm doing something wrong, then what does it matter if they assume I'm doing something wrong biblically, if I'm doing something wrong rabbinically? Either way, they think I'm doing something wrong, and they're going to learn from me mistakenly to do something wrong in their own lives as well. And therefore, the Shach says he doesn't agree with this Rama, and he says it really shouldn't make a difference at all. We should assume that either way, if someone is going to interpret my actions and come away with the wrong impression, we need to be concerned, and this is something we need to stay away from. As we mentioned, this is something that is very relevant to non-dairy creamers today. So you go to a wedding, and they'll obviously serve meat at the wedding, And at the end of the wedding, they're going to serve coffee sometimes, right? If they serve that and somebody asks for non-dairy creamer, okay, if anybody knows who this is, Vanessa Waldman, left her sitter here. So you have to be concerned that maybe someone is going to have the mistaken impression. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, I think the policy of the OU is the only way they're allowed to serve the non-dairy creamer at the end of a wedding or at the end of a banquet, whatever, that was meat, the only way they're allowed to do it is if it's clearly marked and it says non-dairy creamer. They have a sign next to it. The reason for that is based on this shach, where the shach says if someone is going to think that you're doing something wrong, doesn't matter if you're doing something wrong biblically or you're doing something wrong rabbinically, either way, someone's going to assume that you are doing something wrong. The question that we need to ask ourselves is, do we assume that this halacha of Maris Ayin is frozen in time? And whatever examples the Gemara gave of Maris Ayin are the ones we have to be concerned about. So if I have this body of water that's right next to the Avodah Zarah, okay, I won't bow down to get the water. And if I have this ring, then I shouldn't wear the ring. And if I'm going to have the cases that are discussed in the Gemara about milk and human milk and extract and other things, maybe that's where I have to be concerned. But do we update the whole prohibition of Maris Ayin according to our set of circumstances in our generation? Or do we say that no, whatever Chazal, whatever the rabbis came up with at the time is where it stays, whatever the Gemara decided is what it is, and now we don't have to be concerned. So say, for example, I go to a McDonald's, right? So everybody knows that McDonald's is not kosher. However, everybody also knows that the only reason I'm going in is because I need to use the restroom or because I want to get a drink, and everyone knows that I'm not going in to get anything else. So is that something we need to be concerned about Maris Ayin? Or would you say, no, there was no McDonald's in the days of Chazal. In the days of the Gemara, there was nothing of the sort, and therefore, we don't have to now update the halacha and make new examples that are relevant to our lives. Okay, so that's the question that we need to ask. So here, if you look in the Magen Avraham, anybody know when the Magen Avraham lived? One of the great Gedolim in Poland in the 1600s. Magen Avraham was one of the most important Mefarshim on the Shulchan Aruch HaRachayim, and his commentary is written on every single page. And the Magen Avraham writes the following halacha with regard to Hilchos Pesach. And this is what's amazing about halacha. This is what's amazing about learning Torah, that sometimes you have to go to Hilchos Pesach to get the answer to your question that is in Yerideya. And you have to put all of it together to figure out what the proper perspective is supposed to be and what the halacha comes to a conclusion about. So he writes about a phenomenon. Beconstantina. Okay, everyone with me? This is number Dalid. Beconstantina nagu iser lasos, I don't know what that is, olatagin dagin bematza afuya mishum da asi lachlufe. Some kind of mixture, some kind of ingredients that you're going to use which are made up of matzah meal. So he says they have this very interesting practice in Constantine that they do not use matzah meal mishum da asi lachlufe. On Pesach, they don't use matzah meal. Now, what is matzah meal? Matzah meal is when you have matzah that has already been baked, and now you crush it up and make it into a flour. Not a flour, but that kind of substance, a powdery substance, and you're going to use it as an ingredient. Now, the truth is, once it's already been baked, it cannot become chametz. You took away its ability to be chametz. So why would there be any prohibition to use it on Pesach? What's the problem? What can possibly happen? Nothing. But he says, yet, there were those who were very careful not to use matzah meal on Pesach. The Pri Chadash, who lived at the same time as the Magen Avraham, they passed away 10 years apart. The Magen Avraham passed away in 1683. Pri Chadash passes away in 1695 or something like that, 1698. I don't remember the dates exactly, but they were very close in age. The Pri Chadash comes along and he says, what do you mean? Why would there be any prohibition? This was not a phenomenon that existed in the days of the Gemara. There was no matzah meal concept back then. And therefore, the Chachamim, the rabbis in the times of the Gemara, did not include this in the prohibition of Maris Ayin. So who are you to come along and say that people are not allowed to use this in their ingredients when cooking for Pesach? What's the problem? This is the crux of what they're arguing about. Do we update the halacha in every generation? Which would make a lot of sense. Why? Because if the whole nature of the halacha is we don't want people to think negatively or to learn a negative character trait because of what I'm doing, then of course it should be updated and made relevant in every subsequent generation based on the things that people are going to interpret from what they see me doing. Right? But that is basically the discussion in the 1600s. How exactly does this work? Now, how does this relate to Hanukkah? So the Gemara says in Masechet Shabbos, a very fascinating halacha. The Gemara says, let's say I have a chatzer sheyeshla shnei psachim. Let's say I have a house that has two access points, that has two doorways. So, for example, I live in a very large house, and my house has entrances on both sides of the avenue. One is to this side, and one is to the other side. Now, not everybody that walks by on this side is also going to walk by on the other side. Different sides of the street. People are going to different locations. So someone's going to walk by my house on a night of Hanukkah. They're going to look at my front door, look at the windows, and they're going to say, oh, Schefter claims to be so religious. Meanwhile, I walk by his house on Hanukkah night, and there was no menorah there. Now, they don't know that I already lit menorah on the other side of the house because I have a doorway, I have an entryway facing the other side of the avenue. So the Gemara says, when you have a situation like that, where somebody can possibly, potentially walk by on one side of the house and not be aware of the fact that there's a menorah on the other side of the house, the Gemara says, after light, both menorahs on two sides of the house, mipnei marasai. Because we're concerned that someone's going to walk by and mistakenly think that I didn't light Hanukkah candles, or mistakenly think that you don't have to light Hanukkah candles, and therefore, because of that concern, I have to be mindful of it, and I have to light a menorah on this side of my house, as well as on the other side of my house. There's a very fascinating question that is raised by the Beis Halevi. I was just with my father by the OU, and I asked him this question. I think it's a very compelling question. What is the halacha? The Gemara has a discussion. What is the halacha if you have a candle for Hanukkah that is lit, and then it goes out? Goes out 5 minutes after you light it. So if it goes out as you're lighting it, it never really got off the ground. It didn't really start. But let's say it was lit, and everything was good. So what is the halacha? The Gemara has a discussion. Kavsa zakukla, or kavsa ein zakukla, which means, kavsa means that it goes out. Zakukla, do I have to pay attention and make sure to relight it? Or do you say, no, I did my mitzvah. My mitzvah was to light the candle. What happens afterward is not my problem. Kavsa ein zakukla. I don't have to be concerned about it because I have done what I need to do. What happens afterward is not of concern to me. That is the discussion in the Gemara. How do we paskin in Shulchan Aruch? Anybody know? Yeah? Correct. Kavsa ein zakukla. The halacha is, if it goes out, you don't have to worry because your mitzvah is to light a candle. So long as you did what you were supposed to do, what happens afterward is not your concern. Now, the Magen Avraham is quick to point out, that's only provided that you lit it in a way where it would have had the possibility to continue to light, to remain lit. But say, for example, I light it outside in the street and it's windy, and there's no way that it's ever going to last for another 15, 20 minutes. So then, we would say you have to keep relighting it. You have not performed your mitzvah because you didn't even give yourself the possibility for it to remain lit. But let's say I'm lighting here where there's no wind, there's no reason to assume that it's not going to remain lit, and then for whatever reason, the wick burns out, would I have an obligation to relight it? The Gemara says no. Ask the Beis HaLevi, while it's true that I have fulfilled my obligation because I lit it, and now I don't have a responsibility to go back and light it again because the halacha is kapsa ein zakukla, ask the Beis HaLevi, why would this be any different than the case of Chashad? When I have a house with two sides of the street, one entrance this way, one entrance the other way, the halacha is I have to light a menorah here and I have to light a menorah there. Why? Because I have to be concerned that someone's going to pass on one side of the avenue and they're going to think that I didn't light Neres Hanukkah, or someone's going to pass on the other side of the avenue and think that I didn't light Neres Hanukkah. So therefore, I have to make sure not to get involved in any of those problems. I have to light on both sides, says the Beis HaLevi. So now, let's say I have a simple house and I only have one entryway, and I lit the menorah and it went out 5 minutes later. Somebody's going to get off the train, walk by my house 10 minutes after this Zman Hadlaka. They're going to see, oh, Schefter doesn't have a menorah. So you're right. Kavsa ein zakukla. The halacha is I don't have to relight it, but because of Maris Ayin, why don't I have to relight it? Isn't that a good question? I think it's a great question. My father thought it was a great question. So it's something just thought-provoking, something to consider. Why do I not have to light it anyway, forgetting the dynamics of Hadlakas Neres Hanukkah and all of the details about how it works, but why don't I have to relight it just because of Maris Ayin? Because someone who walks by my house is not going to be aware that I am doing the mitzvah of Hanukkah candles as I am supposed to do. Parenthetically, there's a very interesting discussion. So let's say I have one of these houses, a huge mansion, one side of the avenue here, one side of the avenue there. The Gemara says I have to light in both places. Okay. Would I make a bracha in both places? Why not?
You already fulfilled the mitzvah.
You already fulfilled the mitzvah. So you are arguing that when I do the first lighting, that's my mitzvah. The only reason why I'm doing the second lighting is not because I have to do my mitzvah again, but rather because people are going to think negatively about me. In order to make sure that people don't have a negative impression, now I'm going to light a second menorah. But that's not the mitzvah. That's just a side reason, a side consideration of why I have to make light it again. But I wouldn't make a bracha because, after all, that is not my obligation. I don't have a mitzvah to light here and to light again there. My mitzvah is already done in place A. That is correct. Shulchan Aruch quotes that from the Rishonim. Let's try to think of another example. Anybody know another example where you have a mitzvah that you do only because of Maor Sa'ayin? And think about whether or not you have to make a bracha. It's an example that I'm sure has never, ever, and will never come up in your life. So it might be a hard example to think about. Anyone here ever heard of a ben pakua? A ben pakua means, the Torah tells us, when you have an animal and you want to eat it, there are very strict guidelines, very strict rules of how exactly you're supposed to slaughter it. It has to be like this, like that. A whole Gemara Maseches Chulin discusses what is the allowance that a person will have to then consume this animal after it has been slaughtered properly. Okay. Now, the Gemara introduces us to a fascinating phenomenon. What happens if you have a cow that is slaughtered and everything was done properly, and then after you do everything, you open up the animal and you see that the cow was pregnant. So it's already been slaughtered, and now you find that there's a kid, whatever it's called, a smaller cow? What?
A calf.
A calf? Yes, a calf. Thank you. You find that there's a calf inside. Would that now require its own shechita, its own slaughtering, or not? Shulchan Aruch says no. The Gemara says no. Because the slaughtering that you did on the mother counts for both. Now, it's very strange, because the slaughtering you did on the mother worked for the mother, but this calf is still alive. So what do you mean? You slaughtered the mother, but this child is still alive. But yet the Gemara says it's referred to as a ben pakua, when you find the live animal inside of its mother after the shechita, after the slaughtering was done, you would not be required to do a shechita on the child. However, before you walk out, however, I don't want you to get the wrong impression. However, midrabanan, you need to do a shechita. Why? Good, you're good. Rabbanan, you're allowed to do a shechita. You have to do a shechita. Why? Because we have to be concerned that someone's going to see. You have this calf running around your field, and one fine day you just take it off the field, put it on your dining room table, and start eating it. Everyone's going to say, what do you mean? You're not allowed to eat an animal without a proper slaughtering. You're going to say, no, you don't understand. 5 years ago, I slaughtered the mother, and this was the calf that was inside, and we've been like letting it run around outside just to grow it a little bit, and now here we are. We were hungry today. We needed something for dinner, so we just went outside, took the calf, and of course it doesn't need to be, so everyone's going to say, what are you talking about? People who see this are going to walk away with a mistaken impression that you're not careful about slaughtering, about shechita, or that they don't have to chef their animals either. They're going to walk away with the wrong takeaway message. And therefore the Gemara says, Mishum Maris Ha'ayin. Because people are going to have the mistaken impression, therefore I need to do a shechita, therefore I need to do the act of slaughtering on the calf, even though I really do not have an obligation to do so. Okay, now when you do that, would I have to make a bracha on the shechita or not? Would I have to make a bracha on the slaughtering or not? What would you say?
Yeah.
Yeah, why yeah?
It's a real shechita.
And this is a real lighting menorah. What? You're saying if I'm presenting a question, then it means the answer is yes. That's correct. Yes, so this is a big problem because the Shulchan Aruch quotes from the Rashba that when you slaughter a ben pakua, which again, the only reason why you're slaughtering it is because of Maor Sa'ayin, you would have to make a bracha. So why is it when I light my second menorah, I don't make a bracha? And when I slaughter the ben pakua, I do need to make a bracha. The same thing. The nature of them should be the same. It's a good question. Yeah?
Well, maybe like you're really doing halakha, but it's not a real mitzvah, as opposed to the shechita that, like, you know, there's no chiyav, but there's the chiyav of shechita.
Yeah, so that's the kind of answer we need to give. You have to work it out a little bit more in the details, but it's a question that's troubling many, many of the Achronim to figure out, where do you draw the line? Or for example, the Chasam Sofer talks about the following case. I don't know if it ever happened, but he talks about the following case. A boy has a bris milah, and then he becomes a very, very overweight young child, and you can no longer tell that he had a bris milah. So the halacha is, you have to do something to take away the skin because of maris ayin, because people are going to think he never had a bris milah. Would you make a bracha on that or not? So that's a discussion in the Chasam Sofer. When you're doing a bris milah, which is obviously not a real bris milah, he had one, he had a circumcision when he was 8 days old, but then his skin grew over, would you then make a bracha on that act which is only being done mishum maris ayin? So this is a big discussion in the Chasam Sofer and the Crazy Place. The other Achronim try to figure out, what are the guidelines? When would we say that this mitzvah is really becoming a real mitzvah, like you said? When you're doing the shechita, it's like a real shechita. I'm not sure why it's more real than lighting the Hanukkah candles the second time, or like the bris milah. That's the question. Yeah.
When they're, like, for the case of Alakas Neros, let's say you were to put a sign in the other window, like, look on the other side for the menorah, then yeah. Would that fix the problem?
So, that's a good question.
Because if it was, then, yeah, then. Yeah, like, you don't need to do the halakha, you're just choosing to do the halakha as opposed to making a sign.
Yes, correct. And now I don't understand why, when the Gemara tells us you have to light a second menorah, why does it say you have to light a second menorah? Why can't you just simply put a sign up on the second door that says, go to the other side of the street and you'll see what's going on there, right? I that to me is a very strong question. I'm not sure exactly why. Yeah?
Would it be possible to make a chiluk between lighting the menorah and pure simhanis?
That what?
That if it's just for pure simhanis, then you could just yotze with one, but if it's for Mar Ayin specifically for lighting the menorah, and not that they're not being yotze pure simhanis, then they would need to light the second one.
Why is it not Pirsa Manes on the other side of the house?
Because you don't need to be Pirsa Manes wherever you go. It's not like you walk around with menorah. It's everywhere.
Depends who you ask, right?
Well,
I went to the Chabad lighting on the ellipse by the White House. Yes, they do feel very strongly that, you know, everywhere you go, you need to have a menorah on your back.
I know.
You've never seen the Chabad cars that have menorah on the top of the car, on the sunroof?
Yeah. Our dorms, we're lighting and being Pirsa Manes for each other. It's not like we've been doing it for anyone on the street, so... If your house is on both sides, then I don't just be able to say that specific section. It makes sense that you'd only need one. And if the second one goes out, you wouldn't need to.
Yeah, could be. I don't know. It's an interesting point. I think Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach does write that all of this discussion about Maris Ayin when it comes to Hanukkah candles, he thinks is not really relevant to our situation today. Why? Let's try to think about why. What would be different about today? I think the explanation he gives is so simple. He says, before they had electric lights, what happened? Everyone went to work during the day. Everyone was out and about doing what they needed to do. Everyone came home at the same time, right? Everyone came home at 5 o'clock in the afternoon in the winter. There was no light outside. Everyone lit candles at the same time. And if somebody walked by your house and didn't see candles lit, it was because you obviously didn't light candles. There's no other way to explain it. But now he says, when we all run our own schedules and you have a wedding and you're flying out of town and this one is going to a business meeting and everyone's coming home at different times, some people light at 5:30 and some people light at 6:30 and some people light at 10:30 at night. I got home the first night of Hanukkah at 11:30 at night. That's when I lit. I was very troubled by it. I wasn't comfortable with the fact that I wasn't able to light at this man, but what can you do? These are the dynamics of our lives as we live them today. And therefore, as a result of that, Shlomo Zalman Auerbach writes, somebody who walks by your house and doesn't see a menorah lit assumes that you went away for the weekend, assumes that you had a business meeting, assumes that you're busy doing other things and you're going to light later, or you're just away and you're not here, which is totally normal for members of our community. And therefore, he says, the whole concern of Maris Ayin when it comes to Hanukkah candles is not very compelling in the first place in the generation that we live today. The flip side of that will be the following. How long do you think you need to have the Hanukkah candles burning for? Yeah?
30 minutes.
Where does 30 minutes come from? Who came up with this magical number of 30 minutes? Yeah?
But there were no more people going around in the street. Like,
so the Gemara says, how long do my Hanukkah candles need to be lit? Ad shetichle haregel min hashuk. Until people stop roaming around the streets. How long is that going to be? How long after it gets dark outside? How long after sunset will people still be roaming the streets? What's the maximum amount of time? 30 minutes. Why 30 minutes? Because after that, who's on the streets after 30 minutes? You can't see anything. Who's going out of their house? And that's why the idea of 30 minutes came to be, because that is the maximum amount of time, until people stop wandering around the streets, wandering around the marketplace. That is how long you have to have the candles burning. Okay, translate that into today's culture and today's society. How long should it be? Should be all night. We have people, not all night, right?
I mean, in New York
but
City.
It depends where you live. If you live in New York City, it's not strange that somebody's going to be walking by your window at 2 o'clock in the morning, right? It happens all the time. If you live in a quiet neighborhood, so maybe till 10 o'clock at night is reasonable, right? People are driving by. Of course, there are always one or two people driving. But for most common folk, they're going to be driving around till 9:30, 10 o'clock, 10:30 at night. It's not unusual. If you live in Manhattan, if you live in the city, it could be much later. The story is told about the Brisker Rav, that there was a movie theater in Geula or Mei Sharim in the 1940s, I think. And they asked him, when it comes to Hanukkah, how long do you have to keep your Hanukkah candles lit? And he said, well, there's a movie theater there, and people are there until, whatever, 11:30 at night, so therefore we have to have the candles lit that long. So again, it's interesting how the dynamics change. Shlomo Zalman Auerbach says, the dynamics of our world have changed, and therefore the whole Marasayan doesn't apply, because when somebody walks by my window and doesn't see the candles, they're not going to assume that I am absolving myself of the mitzvah of Neres Chanukah, because they're going to assume I went away for the weekend, I'm not home, I have a business meeting, I'm traveling, whatever it is. No one's going to think the worst, and therefore he says Marasayan may not apply in today's generation. On the flip side, when you do light Neres Chanukah, perhaps you should try to have candles that are going to burn for more than 30 minutes. Why? Because today, since the dynamics of our lives have changed, and since people are on the go and people are moving around much more, therefore I have to assume that more than 30 minutes after sundown, there is a possibility of somebody passing by my house, and that's something I have to be mindful of. Yeah?
All of this is super subjective to who you are and who's usually walking by, or even when you're cooking, who's in your house and when you're cooking and all that time. So, I mean, for this example specifically, what if there was a person who lived in a very poor neighborhood and they didn't have the money to go to all these trips, or they know that they don't have business meetings, and people that walk by their house are more, I don't know, they're closer family friends and know they're home or something like that.
So then it would apply. Of course it would.
So are all these rules very subjective to the case
yes,
of the person?
Yes, very much so. But I that actually leads me into the last one we're going to talk about. So please tell me if this addresses your question. One final thing to discuss when we talk about this general issue of Marasayan is exactly what you mentioned. And that is, let me just give an example of the point as follows. We have a prohibition in Chumash of kilayim. You're not allowed to wear an article of clothing that is made up of wool and linen, of shatnets, right? So wool and linen are not allowed to be sewn together in the creation of any item that I'm going to wear. Okay, so the Mishnah says a Maseches Kilayim. Listen to the Mishnah as follows. Mishnah says, if I have silk fabric, I'm not allowed to sew that together, I'm not allowed to weave it together in a garment with wool or linen. Why not? Why not? The prohibition in the Torah is, you're not allowed to sew together wool and linen. Why am I not allowed to sew together silk and linen, or silk and wool? What's the problem? So the Mishnah says, Mishum Marasayim. Because people don't know the difference between silk and wool. And therefore, they're going to assume, when they see you sewing together the silk and linen, they're going to assume that it's wool and linen. And that's shatnez, that's kilayim. And since you're not allowed to have kilayim, you're also not allowed to have silk together with either of those items either. Because people are going to mistakenly think that you're sewing together kilayim. That is what the Mishnah says. Okay. Along comes the Rush. The Rush is one of the Gedolei Rishonim, and he says, although this is what the Mishnah tells us, in our generation, he says, the Rush lived in Germany, he says, we live in an enlightened generation. We live in a generation where people are much more knowledgeable. He lived in the 1300s, where people have a much better understanding of what's going on in the world. And therefore, he says, nobody in their right mind today is going to have a mistake and think, oh, I see you sewing together two things. That's wool and linen. That's a prohibition of shatnez. No, says the Rush. Everyone nowadays knows the difference between silk and wool, between silk and linen. Take one look at it. You know exactly what it is. Maybe, he says, in the times of the Mishnah, people weren't as educated, and the common folk had no idea how to differentiate, how to distinguish between this kind of fabric and that kind of fabric. But today, you take one look at the fabric, and all of us know, without even being knowledgeable in these areas, we all know the difference. And therefore, says the Rush, it's a totally unreasonable thing to worry about. Someone's going to walk by, like you said, someone's going to walk by and think I'm doing something wrong when everybody knows the difference between silk and other fabrics? What's the concern? And therefore, the Rush does something very unusual. The Rush basically scratches out an entire halacha in the Mishnah. And he says that it's no longer relevant to our generation because it doesn't conform to the circumstances of what everybody in our generation knows today. So that's part of your point, right? So what we learned from that is that when we talk about the whole prohibition of Maris HaAyin, when we talk about this concern of people are going to have a wrong impression, people are going to walk away thinking I'm doing wrong, or people are going to learn to do wrong on their own, it has to be reasonable. It has to be realistic. It has to be something that is logical. But to be worried about someone's conspiracy theories and they're going to concoct all these ideas and come up with all kinds of theories of what I'm doing wrong, which are totally unreasonable, totally divorced from the reality, and something that's just someone's wild imagination, it's clear that I don't have to be concerned about that. Maris HaAyin has a limit. I don't have to make myself crazy to really be concerned of somebody who's going to have a thought that is totally divorced from the reality of what is actually happening. That is what we learn from this Rush, and that is quoted in the Halacha and the Shulchan Aruch. That being the case, that we don't have to worry about far-fetched conclusions that people are going to draw, or we don't have to worry about totally absurd and remote possibilities that somebody may conjure up in their minds. If that is the case, then let us go back to the Mishnah that we started with and ask ourselves the following question. What is the first Mishnah we started with? Mishnah writes in Masechet Shkalim, when you have the treasurer of the Beis HaMikdash, goes to count up the money, he's not allowed to have pockets, he's not allowed to wear his shoes, he can't wear any sandals, because people are going to be concerned. There's a concern. Maybe someone's going to say, oh, he stole some money, he stuck it into his shoes. Okay. Someone's going to be concerned, maybe he stuck it into his tefillin. When was the last time ever in the history of the world that you heard of someone who stuck something into his tefillin? Again, you have a smuggler who wants to bring drugs into Israel, so he's going to open up his tefillin. Maybe. And that's the reason why it was on the news, because it never happens, right? It happens once. But what's the likelihood? How many people, honestly, are going to walk into the Beis HaMikdash when he's doing his job and say, ah, I know where he hid this stuff. He hid it in his tefillin. And of course, he's walking in barefoot and he has no pockets on his clothing and he has no sandals. But I know he's walking in with his tefillin. Of course, that's what he's doing. Who's going to think that? So you're going to have one person who has a wild imagination in the Beis HaMikdash who's going to walk away having that conclusion, and that's who we have to worry about? And because of that person who thinks of something that is so improbable, as a result of that, we now have to go to the extreme and tell him to take his tefillin off before he goes to count the money. Does that make sense? How does that correspond to the reality of what we see in the Rush? The Rush says if we live in a generation where everyone is knowledgeable of a certain set of facts and circumstances, we don't have to be concerned otherwise. And therefore, today, sewing something together with silk is no longer a concern, even though it may have been in the times of the Mishnah. Because Maris HaAyin has to be reasonable. Maris HaAyin has to be something that is justifiable for a person to actually think. But this, which is such a wild story that someone's coming up with, does not have to be my primary concern. So why then are we concerned in this Mishnah Masechet Shkalim? I think it's a very powerful question. And the answer, Rav Asher Weiss told me a number of years ago, the answer is because there's a difference between a person leading his or her own life and a person who's in a position of communal leadership. If you are in a position of communal leadership, you need to live life so far beyond anyone's ability to ever come up with any story against you. Now again, it's not always possible, but you have to do everything in your control. When you hold a position of public trust, of public confidence, you have to go to excessive and drastic measures, extraordinary measures, which are beyond what is expected of anyone else. Yes, maybe it's fair, maybe it's not fair, but someone in a position of public confidence and public trust is held to a much higher standard. And as a result of that, we have to be very careful. If you are someone who holds a position of leadership in a community, it means the community is trusting you. And it means you have to be mindful of even something which is a wild imagination that someone might have negatively about you, which is divorced from the reality of what really goes on in your life. But that's what the Mishnah is teaching us. Although there are clear guidelines for a individual person when dealing with Ma'aras Ayin. How far do I need to worry? What do I need to do? What do I need to not do? How careful do I need to be? There is a limit to how careful I need to be. When it comes to someone who holds a position of communal leadership, there is no limit. There is no limit to how careful you can be and how careful you need to be. And one always needs to be mindful. I can say with confidence, there is going to be someone in this room who someday will be in a position of communal leadership. Doesn't have to be communal leadership in the Jewish community. It might be in your field of medicine. It might be in your field of law. Or whatever you're going to end up doing, there is someone in this room who is going to hold a position that is not just going to be your individual and private life. You are going to get to a place where people trust you, where people have confidence in you, where people are scrutinizing everything you do. It's not an easy life. I'm in such a position. And people have a comment and an opinion about everything you do and everything they think you do and everything they think you don't do. And you have to be very careful. It's not that we live all of life trying to please other people, but we need to be mindful of the fact that some people are going to think whatever they're going to think, and we need to try to preempt it. We need to try to prevent the feelings and the thoughts that they have, because there's a trust that they put in public positions that they entrust us with. And we have to be so careful when we hold that public trust, when we hold that public space, that we uphold it with dignity, that we uphold it with a careful sense of deliberation, that we're as mindful as we can be of what it is that people think they experience, what it is that people think they see, and how it is that we can best give over the most positive of outlooks and perspectives for people that look up to us and for people who trust in us. So